content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today I'll be reading from the February 25th, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine. I'll read an article about the election fraud hearings in the North Carolina 9th Congressional District, and then another article about Eugene V. Debs, who ran for president 5 times as a candidate for the Socialist Party of America. So I'll start today with an article by Doug Bach Clark entitled "The Tearful Drama of North Carolina's Election Fraud Hearings: How Mark Harris, a prominent Republican pastor in Charlotte, lost his way in the 9th Congressional District." Before Mark Harris became a preacher, he wanted to be a politician. As a teenager, he stuffed mailers for Ronald Reagan. In college, he had his picture taken with Jesse Helms on the steps of the U.S. Capitol. As the leader of the North Carolina Baptist Convention, he spearheaded a statewide effort to ban gay marriage, which he used as a springboard to run for the U.S. Senate in 2014. "I was willing to do whatever it took to be the man that God would use," he said in a speech the following year to other religious leaders, "and sacrifice whatever needed to be sacrificed." But his Senate bid came short, and in 2016 he lost a Republican primary for North Carolina's 9th Congressional District. In last year's midterm elections, Harris defeated the centrist incumbent in the Republican primary by 828 votes and faced off against the Democrat Dan McCready, a former Marine and solar power entrepreneur, in what became one of the hardest fought races in the nation. Although gerrymandering had kept the 9th District in Republican hands for nearly 2 generations, analysts speculated that not even the multiple rallies that President Don Trump held for Harris's campaign could stop the blue wave. But on election night, Harris was declared the victor by 905 votes, despite losing 6 of 8 counties in the district. "Thank God for Bladen County," Harris declared. On Monday, the North Carolina State Board of Elections convened a special hearing to consider whether Harris had stolen the congressional seat. In early December, the bipartisan agency had refused to certify the election results because of irregularities discovered with hundreds of mail-in ballots, most of which had originated in Bladen County. In the course of last week's hearings in Raleigh, investigators laid out their case. Based on at least 172 interviews and tens of thousands of pages of records, that the election had been tainted by a, quote, coordinated, unlawful, and substantially resourced absentee ballot scheme, end quote. At the center of the scandal was the Republican operative Harris. At the center of the scandal was the Republican operative Harris had employed in Bladen County, Leslie McCray Dowless, whose operation, according to investigators, included filling out at least 1,000 mail-in ballot requests, many without voters' knowledge, and deploying a team of friends, family members, and other associates to pose as election officials and collect them. Votes for Democrats were allegedly tossed out, and everything else was cast or altered for Harris. Among the important questions to be answered at the hearings was what Harris knew about Dowless's scheme and when he knew about it. North Carolina's Republican establishment had vehemently maintained that Harris should be allowed to claim the vacant congressional seat. At a meeting of the state's GOP executive committee on February 9th, Harris had blamed the controversy on, quote, a liberal activist, end quote, on the Board of Elections, and dismissed the allegations of absentee ballot fraud as, quote, unsubstantiated slandering driven by the, quote, liberal media, end quote. A month earlier, in an interview with a local TV station, Harris insisted that he had only become aware of concerns about Dowless when the North Carolina Board of Elections declined to certify the race. Since then, he said, his team had fully cooperated with the investigation. We've tried to do it right, he said. We've tried to follow the process. On the first day of the hearings, Lisa Britt, the daughter of Dallas's ex-wife, said she collected more than 30 ballots, which she gave to Dallas. She also said that she altered between 5 and 10 ballots herself. Britt described extensive efforts to hide the fraud. Ballots were sent at staggered times, mailed from the post office nearest a voter's home, and the ink color of fraudulent witness signatures was carefully matched with those of voters. Britt also produced a typed message from Dallas, given to her a few days before her testimony, which instructed her to say he was free of guilt and to plead the fifth. She trusted Dallas, she said, because he, quote, has been a father figure to me for 30 years, end quote. And she didn't expect him, quote, to put you out here to do something illegal, end quote. Later that day, Dallas himself took the fifth. Over the next 2 days, Andy Yates, who effectively ran Harris's campaign through his political consultancy, Red Dome, spent 8 hours on the stand. Later, Harris testified that he had expected Yates to provide oversight of Dallas. Yates said that his background check on Dallas consisted of a Google search and a cursory look at courtrecords.org, which revealed 3 misdemeanor charges, including assault on a female. Dallas also has a felony fraud conviction. According to Yates, this was not a concern because Harris, who had already settled on the hire, had alerted him that Dallas had charges, quote, related to a divorce, end quote. Yates said that Dallas also ensured him that his absentee ballot program was legal. During the campaign, Yates paid Dallas more than $130,000, including a monthly fee that rose to more than $1,600 and around $2.50 for each mail-in ballot collected by one of Dallas's workers. Yates never asked to see any receipts. If his word was good enough for Dr. Harris, Yates said, it was good enough for me. At the close of Yates' testimony, Kim Stratch, the director of the North Carolina Board of Elections, asked if Yates had any recollection of someone warning him about Dallas. When he said that he did not, she pressed him. I just want to ask you, she said, do you recall having a phone conversation with Dr. Harris's son, John Harris? Yates, who appeared surprised, denied being warned by John Harris about Dallas. If that conversation happened, he said, I do not recall it happening. Strach could hardly suppress a smile. Okay, she said, that's all I have. Ever since the scandal broke in late November 2018, Harris's son, John, a 29-year-old federal prosecutor in Raleigh, had restricted contact with his father, speaking to him only at holiday gatherings, and after Harris was hospitalized for a severe infection in early 2019. Around 11 o'clock on the evening after Yates' testimony, John's younger brother, Matthew, told his father that John would be testifying the next day. I don't want you to be shocked, Harris later recalled Matthew saying. In fact, during the first 2 days of testimony, John had been sequestered in a room separate from most of the other witnesses. Moments before he was sworn in, on the third day, the lawyers for Harris's campaign frantically attempted to submit additional evidence, email correspondence between John and his father spanning the previous 2 years. Josh Lawson, the general counsel for the Board of Elections, initially refused the offer. It quickly became clear that the state had already had access to them. I thought what Dallas was doing was illegal, and I was right, John said during his testimony. Dallas, he added, had told his parents and other campaign associates that, quote, he wasn't doing any of this, and they believed him, end quote. Seated near the front of the room, about 25 feet away from his son, Harris placed three fingers over his mouth and silently wept. According to the emails and John's subsequent testimony, Harris first became aware of Dowlais in June of 2016, during his first run for the 9th District seat. On the night of the primary election, John returned home from the United States Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C., where he then worked as a law clerk to watch the returns on the Board of Elections website. John testified that when Robert Pittenger won by 134 votes, the margin was so slim that he began poring over voting data, looking for anything that might spur a recount for his father. Soon, he discovered an anomaly in the mail-in ballots in Bladen County. Todd Johnson had won 214, Harris had scored 4, and Pittenger had got 0. At 11:04, he sent an email to his father noting that, quote, "this smacks of something gone awry," end quote. Initially, John thought it was, quote, "an error in the counting machine," end quote, but as he kept digging, he noticed that absentee ballots had arrived in batches, as if someone were collecting and delivering them all at once. John recalled that he and his father soon became aware, through a campaign staffer, that Johnson had, quote, "someone in Bladen focused on absentee ballots," end quote. John suggested that his father discuss the situation with his lawyer, but Harris lost the recount. He no longer saw any point in pursuing the case. Still, the experience stayed with him. That year, Dowlais was elected as the county's water quality supervisor, despite the oppositional efforts of a Bladen County Democratic Political Action Committee. After the election, Dowlais accused the group of running an absentee ballot scam to defeat him. The case, which became a touchstone for Republican claims of widespread Democratic voter fraud, was cited by President Trump as proof that Hillary Clinton's victory in the popular vote was illegitimate. On November 15th, Harris forwarded to John a Republican fundraising email with the subject line, "Urgent Democratic Voting Fraud Scheme Uncovered." "Amen," Harris wrote to his son, noting that, quote, "the guy who made the claim, Dowlais, is the same guy that Johnson paid to run the absentee ballot program for him. Guess he didn't like the Dems cutting into his business," end quote. At a hearing in late 2016, as The American Life previously reported, the Board of Elections, which found no evidence of Democratic wrongdoing, dismissed Dowlais' accusations. But not before Dowlais admitted under oath that he had, in fact, paid workers to collect ballots for him. As it became clear that Dowlais was detailing his involvement in a violation of federal election laws, he took the Fifth, which resulted in the state launching a criminal investigation. A few months later, as Harris prepared another run in the 9th District, he actively began courting Dowlais. On March 8, 2017, Harris text messaged a prominent Republican judge in the Bladen County area, asking for an introduction to, quote, "the guy whose absentee ballot project for Johnson could have put me in the U.S. House this term, had I known and he had been helping us." About a month later, Harris met with Dowlais and a group of local Republican power leaders in the showroom of a furniture store. Harris later testified that Dowlais described a legal absentee ballot turnout program in which he paid workers to help voters request absentee ballots and then followed up to encourage them to mail in votes for candidates he supported. However, something about the pitch prompted a call between Harris and his son John later that day to discuss the legality of Dowlais' efforts. The next morning, John sent an email to Harris about the relevant election law statute, which held that it was a Class 1 felony for anyone other than an election official to collect voters' ballots. Quote, the key thing that I am fairly certain they do that is illegal is that they collect the completed absentee ballots and mail them all at once, end quote, John wrote during the exchange. But if they simply leave the ballot with the voter and say, be sure to mail this in, then that's not illegal. In a subsequent email, he offered a final warning, writing, quote, good test is if you're comfortable with the full process he uses being broadcast on the news, end quote. Within a few weeks, Harris had made his decision. He wrote two personal checks for more than $3,300 to Dallas's Political Action Committee. At the hearing, Stretch would later ask Harris if he had understood what it was illegal for campaigns to coordinate it. At the hearing, Stretch would later ask Harris if he had understood that it was illegal for campaigns to coordinate with PACs that are set up for independent spending. Harris said that he did not. John's fears, of course, proved prophetic. Toward the end of his testimony, shaken with emotion, he said, I love my dad and I love my mom, okay? I certainly have no vendetta against them, no family scores to settle. I think that they made mistakes in this process. John, who has two young children, added, I thought a lot more probably about my own little ones than my parents and the world we're building for them. And then he closed with a plea for less partisanship in politics. I'm just left thinking that we can do all a lot better than this, he said. Then, without looking at his father, he stood, buttoned his suit coat, and walked out. As the fourth day of the hearings opened, John Branch, the lawyer for Harris's campaign, stood before the Board of Elections to explain why, on the evening after his team had been shown to be withholding John Harris's emails, he had produced an additional 800 pages of documents. I'm here to own that, Brant said. The previous day, Harris's lawyers had claimed that they had not turned over the emails because of a search term error. Now, during his cross-examination, Branch explained that he had not asked Harris's senior staff to turn over significant amounts of potential evidence under the theory that they were technically contractors for Red Dome, Yates's political consultancy. Branch claimed that the evidence was therefore outside the scope of the subpoena issued to the Harris campaign. But, as the election board officials noted, John's emails with his father almost certainly fell within the remit of a subpoena issued in December 2018. T. Jeff Carman III, a Democratic board member, said, John Harris sat up here yesterday as an example of what attorneys should be. I think it's a disgrace to our profession that the document wasn't submitted to the board through the counsel. A few hours later, Mark Harris took the stand. He again explained that he had thought that Dallas's efforts on his behalf had not included any illegal activities. When asked why he had not heeded his son's advice, Harris said, I thought he was overreacting. John, he added, had only been analyzing the data from afar. My son was still my son, 27 years old, he said. Harris suggested that Dallas's support from blatant GOP officials was more persuasive, and he assumed it was Dallas's personal relationships with voters that allowed him to be so successful gathering absentee ballots. Following his son's testimony the previous day, Harris said he had called John to say he was proud of him. He loved him, he said, but I know he's a little judgmental and has a little taste of arrogance. Just before lunch, Lawson, the Board of Elections counsel, asked Harris, did you prepare to testify about the emails that your son addressed yesterday? Harris evaded multiple versions of the question. Lawson pressed, so did you tell anyone in this past week that you believed that these documents were not part of the evidence in this case? Harris repeatedly answered that he did not recall doing so. But unbeknownst to Harris and his team, Lawson had received a phone call earlier that morning from someone who indicated that Harris, as recently as the night before John's testimony, had said that he did not expect the emails between him and his son to be entered as evidence. Lawson now ceded the floor, and Mark Elias, a prominent Democratic lawyer who represented McCready, opened his cross-examination with a similar line of questioning, confirming, among other things, that Harris understood that he was under oath. Harris's personal lawyer, David Friedman, abruptly broke in, something he had never done in more than 3 decades of practicing law, and asked for a recess. Under ethics rules, Friedman had to halt testimony if he believed that Harris might be lying under oath. An hour passed, and then an extension was granted. Reporters speculated about whether Harris was ready to give up the fight. Others jokingly related the prospect of getting to go home early. Meanwhile, as the Washington Post first reported, the lawyers were engaged in contentious discussions behind the scenes. Friedman invited Lawson and Elias to meet in his office, a stairwell, and asked for the opportunity to confer with his client. If Harris had lied on the stand, he would have to correct his testimony. Otherwise, Friedman would be ethically required to withdraw as his counsel. Before the meeting broke up, Elias told Friedman that he had at least 4 more hours of questions, which he suggested was more than enough time for Harris to perjure himself. In a second meeting, the legal teams assembled in a separate courtroom to discuss whether Harris could read a statement to conclude his testimony without compounding his already mounting legal troubles. Lawson argued that Harris should describe the 2018 election as tainted, which would trigger a re-election even if the number of votes affected by fraud was insufficient to change the outcome. Friedman agreed, but also explained that Harris's testimony had been affected by ill health. Lawson reminded Friedman that Harris had given multiple indications over the past few days that he was competent to testify. Friedman left to consult with Harris. Nearly 2 hours passed before Harris retook the stand. In his statement, he admitted that on Tuesday night he had told his younger son, quote, that I did not think John's emails would be part of this hearing, end quote. Harris explained that recent health problems, including 2 strokes suffered as a result of his infection, had affected his memory more than he had realized. Obviously, I was incorrect in my recollection, he said, and I wholeheartedly apologize to this board. After again denying that he or his senior campaign staff had been aware of improprieties, he said, I believe a new election should be called. Over gasps in the audience, he continued, it become clear to me that the public's confidence in the 9th District seat general election has been undermined to an extent that a new election is warranted. With that, public office slipped away from him for the 3rd time. As Harris walked out of the courtroom, his wife rubbed his back with her hand. The lawyers hung around for questions. Dr. Harris was convinced by his son's testimony to call for a new election, Friedman told me. If he had listened to his son the first time, he would be in Congress by now. And Lawson disagreed. Harris said his decision came after he listened to the evidence, not his son, he said. The evidence showed coordinated fraud, witness intimidation, and shifting testimony that tainted the election. Elias, McCready's lawyer, added, Dr. Harris only did what he did when he was caught lying, and he was given very good legal advice to find a way to correct the record and get off the witness stand as soon as possible. He does not deserve any credit for agreeing to a new election. In some ways, the drama surrounding the 9th District has only just begun. Throughout the hearings, evidence surfaced that suggested early voting totals could have been leaked from Bladen County Board of Elections. This included a text message from Harris's wife to her son John a few days before the 2018 Republican primary. Dallas says we have 988 of the votes in Bladen, she wrote, though this proved to be about 100 more votes than what the campaign actually won. Multiple criminal investigations are ongoing, including at least two opened by the FBI. Officials from the Department of Justice attended the hearing. And the Wake County District Attorney, Lauren Freeman, has indicated that no one who testified was granted immunity. Meanwhile, the board voted unanimously on Thursday to hold a new election, which will be scheduled at a future meeting. Through his attorney, Harris, who had stepped down as a senior pastor of the Charlotte's First Baptist Church to devote more time to his congressional campaign, said he is unsure whether he will run again. And now, an article by Jill Lepore, Eugene V. Debs and the Endurance of Socialism. Half man, half myth, Debs turned a radical creed into a deeply American one. Eugene Victor Debs left school at the age of 14 to scrape paint and grease off the cars of the Vandalia Railroad in Indiana for 50 cents a day. He got a raise when he was promoted to fireman, which meant working in the locomotive next to the engineer, shoveling coal into a firebox. As much as 2 tons an hour, 16 hours a day, 6 days a week. Firemen, caked in coal dust, blinded by wind and smoke, had to make sure that the engine didn't explode. In eventuality, they weren't always able to forestall. If they were lucky and lived long enough, firemen usually became engineers, which was safer than being a switchman or a brakeman, jobs that involved working on the tracks next to a moving train, or racing across its top in any weather at the risk of toppling off and getting run over. All these men reported to the conductors, who had the top job, and on trains owned by George Mortimer Pullman, one of the richest men in the United States, all of them, the engineers, the firemen, the brakemen, the switchmen, and even the scrapers, outranked the porters. Pullman porters were almost always black men and ex-slaves, and at the start were paid nothing except the tips they could earn by bowing before the fancy passengers who could afford the sleeping car, and who liked very much to be served with a shuffle and a grin, Dixie style. Every man who worked on the American Railroad in the last decades of the 19th century became, of necessity, a scholar of the relations between the rich and the poor, the haves and the have-nots, the masters and the slaves, the riders and the ridden upon. No student of this subject is more important to American history than Debs, half-man, half-myth, who founded the American Railway Union, turned that into the Social Democratic Party, and ran for President of the United States 5 times, including once from prison. Debs, who wrote a lot about manliness, always said that the best kind of man was a sand man. Sand means grit, he wrote in 1882 in Fireman's Magazine. It means the power to hold on. When a train stalled from the steepness of the incline or the weight of the freight, railroad men poured sand on the tracks to improve the grip of the wheels. Men need sand too, Deb said. Men who have plenty of sand in their boxes never slip on the path of duty. Debs had plenty of sand in his box. He had, though, something of a morbid fear of ashes. Maybe that's a fireman's phobia, attending the engine man's idea of doom. In prison, having been sentenced brutally to 10 years of hard time at the age of 63, he had a nightmare. I was walking by the house where I was born, he wrote. The house was gone, and nothing left but ashes. Only ashes. Ashes. The question today for socialism in the United States, which appears to be stoking its engines, is whether it's got enough sand, or whether it'll soon be ashes, only ashes, all over again. Debs was born in Terre Haute, Indiana, in 1855, 7 years after Marx and Engels published the Communist Manifesto. His parents were Alsatian immigrants who ran a small grocery store. Debs worked for the railroads a little more than 4 years. In the wake of the Panic of 1873, he lost his job at Vandalia and tramped to East St. Louis looking for work. Then homesick, he tramped back to Terre Haute, where in 1875 he took a job as a labor organizer and later as a magazine editor for the Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen. He hung his old scraper on the wall, part relic, part badge, part talisman of his life as a manual laborer. Debs was a tall man, lanky and rubbery like a noodle. He had deep-set blue eyes and lost his hair early, and he talked with his hands. When he gave speeches, he leaned toward the crowd, and the veins of his temples bulged. He was clean-shaven, and favored bow ties, and sometimes looked lost in crumpled baggy suits. He had a way of hunching his shoulders that you often see and admire in tall men who don't like to tower over other people. In a new book, Eugene V. Debs, A Graphic Biography, published by Verso, drawn by Noah Van Sciver and written by Paul Buell and Steve Max, Debs looks like an R. Crumb character, though not so bedraggled and neurotic. People could listen to him talk for hours. "Debs! Debs! Debs!" they'd cry when his train pulled into a station. Crowds massed to hear him by the tens of thousands. But even though Debs lived until 1926, well into the age of archival sound, no one has ever found a recording of his voice. When Nick Salvatore wrote in his comprehensive biography, Eugene V. Debs, Citizen and Socialist, in 1982, his voice ran a gamut of tones, mock whisper, to an oral conversation, to full stentorian power. You wonder how he knew. Debs could speak French and German, and he was raised in the Midwest. So maybe he talked like the Ohio-born Clarence Darrow, with a rasp and a drawl. Some of Debs' early essays and speeches had just been published in the first of 6 volumes of The Selected Works of Eugene V. Debs, published by Haymarket, edited by Tim Davenport and David Walters. Really, he wasn't much of a writer. The most delightful way to hear Debs is to listen to a recording made in 1979 by Bernie Sanders in an audio documentary that he wrote and produced when he was 37 years old and was the director of the American People's Historical Society in Burlington, Vermont, 2 years before he became that city's mayor. In the documentary, available on YouTube and Spotify, Sanders, the Brooklyn-born son of a Polish Jew, performs parts of Debs' most famous speeches, sounding more or less like Larry David. It is not to be missed. Debs began his political career as a Democrat. In 1879, when he was only 23, he was elected city clerk of Terre Haute as a Democrat. The city's Democratic newspaper called him, quote, one of the rising young men of Terre Haute. And the Republican paper agreed, dubbing him, quote, the blue-eyed boy of destiny, end quote. Debs looked back on those days less fondly. There was a time in my life, before I became a socialist, when I permitted myself as a member of the Democratic Party to be elected to a state legislature, he later said. I have been trying to live it down. I am as much ashamed of that as I am proud of having gone to jail. Throughout his life, he believed in individual striving, and he believed in the power of machines. A railroad is the architect of progress, he said in a speech at the Grand Lodge of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen in 1877, the year the President of the United States sent federal troops to crush a railroad worker strike. The Firemen's Brotherhood was less a labor union than a benevolent society. Debs explained, the first object of the association is to provide for the widows and orphans who are daily left penniless and at the mercy of public charity by the death of a brother. At the time, he was opposed to strikes. Does the Brotherhood encourage strikers? He asked. No, Brotherhood, For a long time, Debs disavowed socialism. He placed his faith in democracy, the franchise, and the two-party system. The conflict is not between capital and labor, he insisted. It is between the man who holds the office and the man who holds the ballot. But in the 1880s, when railroad workers struck time and time again, and as many as 2,000 railroad men a year were killed on the job, while another 20,000 were injured, Debs began to wonder whether the power of benevolence and fraternity was adequate protection from the avarice and ruthlessness of corporations backed up by armed men. "The strike is the weapon of the oppressed," Debs wrote in 1888. Even then, he didn't talk about socialism. For Debs, this was Americanism, a tradition that had begun with the American Revolution. "The nation had for its cornerstone a strike," he said. He also spent some time with a pencil doing sums. "Imagine," he wrote in an editorial, "that a grandson of Cornelius Vanderbilt started out with $2 million, $1 million from his grandfather, and another million from his father. If a locomotive fireman could work 4,444 years, 300 days each year, at $1.50 per day," Debs went on, "he would be in a position to bet Mr. Vanderbilt $2.50 that all men are born equal." In 1889, Debs argued for an industrial union, a federation of all the brotherhoods of railroad workers, from brakemen to conductors, as equals. Samuel Gompers wanted those men to join his far less radical trade union, the American Federation of Labor, which he'd founded 3 years earlier. But in 1893, Debs pulled them into the American Railway Union. Soon, it had nearly 150,000 members, with Debs at its head as their Moses. That's what got him into a battle with George Pullman in 1894 and landed him for the first time in prison, where he read Das Kapital. Debs once said that George Pullman was as greedy as a horse leech, but that was unfair to leeches. In the aftermath of the Panic of 1893, Pullman slashed his workers' wages by as much as 50%, and even though they lived in housing he provided, he didn't cut rents or the price of the food he sold them. 3,000 workers from the Pullman Palace Car Company, many of them American Railway Union members, had already begun a wildcat strike in May of 1894, a month before the ARU's first annual meeting in Chicago. As Jack Kelly recounts in The Edge of Anarchy, The Railroad Barons, The Gilded Age, and The Greatest Labor Uprising in America, published by St. Martin's, Debs had wanted the ARU to get involved, but the members of his union found the Pullman workers' plight impossible to ignore. Excuse me, Debs had not wanted the ARU to get involved, but the members of his union found the Pullman workers' plight impossible to ignore, especially after 19-year-old Jenny Curtis, who'd worked in the Pullman sewing department for 5 years, upholstering and making curtains, addressed the convention. Curtis explained that she was often paid $9 or $10 for 2 weeks' work, out of which she paid Pullman $7 for her board and $2 or $3 more for rent. "We ask you to come along with us," she told Debs' men, "because working for Pullman was little better than slavery." After hearing from her, the ARU voted for a boycott, refusing to handle Pullman cars and equipment. That Curtis had a voice at all that day was thanks in part to Debs, who had supported the admission of women to the ARU. He also argued for the admission of African Americans. "I am not here to advocate association with the Negro, but I am ready to stand side by side with him," he told the convention. But by a vote of 112 to 110, the assembled members decided that the union would be for whites only. If two votes had gone the other way, the history of the labor movement in the United States might have turned out very differently. Black men closed out of the ARU, formed the Anti-Strikers Railroad Union to fill positions opened by striking whites. If working on a Pullman car was degrading, it was also, for decades, one of the best jobs available to African-American men. Its perks included safe travel at a time when it was difficult for black people to make their way between any two American cities without threat or harm. George Pullman's company was the nation's single largest employer of African-American men. Thurgood Marshall's father was a Pullman porter. The ARU voted in 1894 to set back the ARU vote in 1894 set back the cause of labor for decades. The Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters achieved recognition from the Pullman Company only in 1937, after years of organizing by A. Philip Randolph. The Pullman strike of 1894, one of the single biggest labor actions in American history, stalled trains in 27 states. Deb's American Railway Union all but halted transportation by rail west of Detroit for more than a month, either by refusing to touch Pullman cars or by actively unhitching them from the trains. Whatever Deb's initial misgivings about the boycott, once his union voted for it, he dedicated himself to the confrontation between the producing classes and the money power. In the end, after a great deal of violence, George Pullman, aided by President Grover Cleveland, defeated the strikers. Pursued by a U.S. Attorney General who had long served as a lawyer for the railroads, Debs and other ARU leaders were indicted and convicted of violating a federal injunction to stop, quote, ordering, directing, aiding, assisting, or abetting the uprising. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld Debs' conviction. He and seven other organizers were sentenced to time behind bars. Debs to 6 months, the others to three, and served that time in Woodstock, Illinois, in a county jail that was less a prison than a suite of rooms in the back of the elegant two-story Victorian home of the county sheriff, who had his inmates over for supper every night. The Socialist Conversion is the title of the half-page panel depicting these 6 months in Eugene V. Debs, a graphic biography. It shows Debs in a prisoner's uniform, seated at a desk in a bare room, with a beady-eyed, billy club-wielding prison guard looking on from the doorway, while a cheerful man in a suit carrying the Communist Manifesto approaches Debs, his speech bubble reading, "This is a present from the Socialist of Milwaukee to you." Well, very little of this is true. Deb's time in jail in Woodstock was remarkably comfortable. He ran the union office out of his cell. He was allowed to leave jail on his honor. "The other night I had to lock myself in," he told the New York World reporter Nellie Bly when she went to interview him. "There was no sign of the prisoner about Mr. Deb's clothes," Bly reported. "He wore a well-made suit of gray tweed, the coat being a cutaway, and a white starched shirt with a standing collar, and a small black and white scarf tied in a bow knot." The Milwaukee socialist Victor Berger did bring Debs a copy of Marx's Das Kapital, and Debs and his fellow labor organizers dedicated most of the daily schedule to reading. "I had heard but little of socialism before the Pullman strike," Debs later claimed, insisting that the reading he did in jail brought about his conversion. But it's not clear what effect that reading really had on him. "No, sir, I do not call myself a socialist," he told a strike commission that year. While in jail, he turned away overtures from socialists. And when he got out in 1895 and addressed a crowd of more than 100,000 people who met him at the train station in Chicago, he talked about the spirit of 76 and the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, not about Marx and Engels. The next year, Debs endorsed the presidential candidate, William Jennings Bryan, running on both the Democratic and the People's Party's tickets. Only after Bryan's loss to William McKinley, whose campaign was funded by businessmen, did Debs abandon his devotion to the two-party system. The people elected Bryan, it was said, but money elected McKinley. On January 1st, 1897, writing in the Railway Times, Debs proclaimed himself a socialist. The result of the November election has convinced every intelligent wage worker that in politics, per se, there is no hope of emancipation from the degrading curse of wage slavery, he wrote. I am for socialism because I am for humanity. Money constitutes no proper basis of civilization. That June, at the annual meeting of the American Railway Union, Debs founded the Social Democracy of America Party. When it splintered within the year, Victor Berger and Debs joined what became the Social Democratic Party, and then in 1901, the Socialist Party of America. For Debs, socialism meant public ownership of the means of production. Arouse from your slavery. Join the Social Democratic Party and vote with us to take possession of the minds of the country and operate them in the interest of the people, he urged miners in Illinois and Kansas in 1899. But Debs' socialism, which was so starry-eyed that his critics called it impossibilism, was decidedly American and had less to do with Karl Marx and communism than with Walt Whitman and Protestantism. What is socialism, he asked? Merely Christianity in action. It recognizes the equality in men. The myth of Debs' Christ-like suffering and socialist conversion in the county jail dates to 1900. It was a campaign strategy. At the Social Democratic Party convention that March, a Massachusetts delegate nominated Debs as the party's presidential candidate and, in his nominating speech, likened Debs' time in Woodstock to the resurrection. When he came forth from the tomb, it was to a resurrection of life, and the first message that he gave to his class as he came from his darkened cell was a message of liberty. Debs earned nearly 90,000 votes in that year's election, and more than four times as many when he ran again in 1904. In 1908, he campaigned in 33 states, traveling on a custom train called the Red Special. As one story has it, a woman waiting for Debs at a station in Illinois asked, "Is that Debs?" To which another woman replied, "Oh, no, that ain't Debs. When Debs comes out, you'll think it's Jesus Christ." This is our year, Debs said in 1912. And it was, in the sense that nearly a million Americans voted for him for president. But 1912 was also socialism's year in the sense that both the Democratic and the Republican parties embraced progressive reforms long advocated by socialists, and for that matter, by populists. Women's suffrage, trust-busting, economic reform, maximum hour and minimum wage laws, the abolition of child labor, and the direct election of U.S. senators. As Debs could likely perceive a couple of years later, when the Great War broke out in Europe, 1912 was to be socialism's high mark in the United States. "You may hasten socialism," he said. "You may retard it, but you cannot stop it." Except that socialism had already done most of what it would do in the United States in those decades. It had reformed the two major parties. Debs was too sick to run in 1916. The United States declared war on Germany in April 1917. The Bolshevik Revolution swept Russia that November. Debs spoke out against the war as soon as it began. "I am opposed to every war but one," he said. "I am for that war with heart and soul, and that is the worldwide war of the social revolution. In that war, I am prepared to fight in any way the ruling class may make necessary, even to the barricades." Bernie Sanders recorded this speech for his 1979 documentary. And As a member of the Senate, Sanders said it again. There is a war going on in this country, he declared on the floor of the Senate in 2010 in a speech of protest that lasted more than 8 hours. I am not referring to the war in Iraq or the war in Afghanistan. I am talking about a war being waged by some of the wealthiest and most powerful people against working families, against the disappearing and shrinking middle class of our country. After Debs, socialism endured in the six-time presidential candidacy of his successor, Norman Thomas. But it endured far more significantly in Progressive-era reforms, in the New Deal, and in Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. In the decades since Ronald Reagan's election in 1980, many of these reforms have been undone. Monopolies have risen again, and income inequality has spiked back up to where it was in Deb's lifetime. Socialism has been carried into the 21st century by way of Sanders, a Debs disciple, and by way of the utter failure of the two-party system. Last summer, a Gallup poll found that more Democrats view socialism favorably than view capitalism favorably. This brand of socialism has its own obsession with manliness, with its Bernie bros, and allegations by women who worked on Sanders' 2016 presidential campaign of widespread sexual harassment and violence. Sanders' campaign manager, Jeff Weaver, recently addressed some of these changes. Was it too male? Yes. Was it too white? Yes. Hence the movement's new face and new voice, the former Sanders campaign worker, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Debs wrote its manifesto, but there's a certain timidity to the new socialism. It lacks sand. In 1894, one Pullman worker stated the nature of the problem. We are born in a Pullman house, fed from the Pullman shops, taught in the Pullman school, catechized in the Pullman church, and when we die, we shall go to the Pullman hell. We live in Amazon houses and eat Amazon groceries and read Amazon newspapers, and when we die, we shall go to Amazon hell. In the meantime, you can buy your Bernie 2020 hats and an AOC t-shirt on Amazon. Debs was arrested in Cleveland in 1918 under the terms of the 1917 Espionage Act for a speech protesting the war that he had given 2 weeks earlier on June 16th in Canton, Ohio. Debs invites arrest, the Washington Post announced. Most of the nation's newspapers described him as a dictator or a traitor or both. And because what he had said was deemed seditious, newspapers couldn't print it, and readers assumed the worst. But the speech was vintage Debs from its vague blandishments and programmatic promises. Quote, we are going to destroy all enslaving and degrading capitalist institutions and recreate them as free and humanizing institutions. To its astute observations and forceful repetitions, the working class who fight the battles, the working class who make the sacrifices, the working class who shed the blood, the working class who furnish the corpses, the working class have never yet had a voice in declaring war. Debs was one of thousands of socialists jailed during the First World War and the Red Scare that followed, when the Justice Department effectively tried to outlaw socialism. His defense attorney compared him to Christ. You shall know him by his works, and called no one to the stand but Debs, who, during a two-hour oration, talked less about socialism than about the First Amendment. I believe in free speech, in war, as well as in peace, Debs told the court. If the espionage law stands, then the Constitution of the United States is dead. The socialist Max Eastman, watching him speak that day, describes Debs' growing fervor. His utterance became more clear and piercing, and it made the simplicity of his faith seem almost like a portent. Eastman wrote. But it's the speech Debs gave during his sentencing that would be his best remembered address, his American creed. While there is a lower class, I am in it. While there is a criminal element, I am of it. While there is a soul in prison, I am not free. After being sentenced to 10 years, he was taken by train from Cleveland to a prison in West Virginia, where he was held for 2 months before being transferred to the much harsher Atlanta Federal Penitentiary. On the wall of a cell that he shared with five other men, he hung a picture of Jesus wearing his crown of thorns. Refusing to ask for or accept special treatment, he was confined to his cell for 14 hours a day and was allowed 20 minutes a day in the prison yard. He wore a rough denim uniform. He ate food barely fit to eat. He grew gaunt and weak. Debs came to think about the men he met in prison the way he'd once thought about men he'd worked with on the railroad. A prison is a cross-section of society in which every human strain is clearly revealed, he wrote in a memoir called Walls and Bars. But if the railroad was a model of hierarchy, prison was a model of equality. We were all on a dead level there. He became an American folk hero, a champion of free speech. In his From the Jailhouse to the White House campaign in 1920, he earned nearly a million votes running for president as convict number 9653. But a vote for Debs in 1920 was not a vote for socialism. It was a vote for free speech. Convict number 9653 refused to ask for a pardon, even as he grew sicker and leaner and weakened. His reputation as a 20th century Christ grew. Kurt Vonnegut's much beset narrator in Hocus Pocus says, "I am so powerless and despised now that the man I named after Eugene Debs, if he were still alive, might at last be somewhat fond of me." Debs understood capitalism best on a train, socialism best in prison. One of the last letters he wrote was to the judge who had sentenced him in 1918, asking whether his conviction had left him disenfranchised or whether he still had the right to vote. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. Today's broadcast and all of previous New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer.